Quiet, please. You are about to hear the recording of the century. The most controversial audiobiography ever made. A recording that we were warned not to release. We are here in defiance of that warning. We are here because we refuse to be intimidated. It took us thousands of hours to produce this record. We worked in secret. Now we are here with a portrait. A portrait of a great American whose story must be told. We are here with Howard Hughes, super billionaire, super rebel, super prophet, and superstar. There is a prophet in America. A prophet in sneakers and old shirts. A prophet that is both genius and eccentric, both kind and mysterious. A prophet that hides away from public life and yet exercises an anvil hold on that same public life. A prophet that has loved many airplanes and made love to many women. A prophet from Texas with a 10-gallon imagination. A prophet in the bone and flesh of one, Howard Hughes, a billionaire with a purpose. What is this billionaire prophet like? Who is he? He's the man stretched out on a cross of gold. Like the Jesus of old, he is a man who goes his own way. Like the Son of God, he too is a rebel and a thorn in the side of authority. Howard Hughes has stood up in court, in governmental hearings with the army, has been badgered by the press. But everywhere he was attacked, he stood up for his rights and beliefs. Howard Hughes, the prophet of aviation, of motion pictures, the prophet of world affairs, has had to take punishment in this country because he wanted his privacy and the right to be left alone and to go his own way. During his early days of flying, he set many records. Hughes refused to hire flyers. Hughes, the superpilot, flew his own designs. He tried to get the military interested in his new models. The army gave him an order to design an interceptor. He worked like a Trojan on the idea. He worked day and night. He drew his plans up. The army said he'd have to wait while they reviewed the designs of other aircraft companies, particularly those of Lockheed. Finally, the army granted the contract to Lockheed instead of to Hughes. Can you imagine this? This giant Howard Hughes, who loved every moment of his work, had to take a backseat while Lockheed got the contract. It's been said that this happened because Lockheed's so-called representatives took the army brass out to dinners and to the theater because they socialized. And Hughes didn't socialize. He was too busy building his plane. Howard Hughes loves the American people. Hughes is like Davy Crockett, who pushed west and helped settle a country. Hughes has pushed west and east and north and south. He has linked continents together with his airlines. Hughes was head of TWA until power-hungry men forced him out. The big politicians and businessmen of Christ's time crucified him for his ideas. In our own time, Hughes also has been nailed to a cross by the narrow minds of petty people. America, what have you done to your heroes? Wake up! There was a giant in our land who had to leave this country because he was being harassed and interfered with, because he had to fight for privacy. Howard Hughes is one of the greatest Americans and a prophet, too. You can't afford to put your prophets on trial, in government hearings, in the mildewed and moldy prose of gossip columnists. Howard Hughes has always been a loner, like Christ. The leaders laughed in Christ's time when he said he could walk upon the water. In our own time, many of the government leaders and businessmen laughed when Hughes said he could make the world's largest aeroplane and make it fly. They laughed. The laughter of ignorance and stupidity. But Hughes built that aeroplane, an aeroplane made entirely of wood and called the Spruce Goose, and he flew it in 1947 by himself, the largest aeroplane ever constructed by man. After this record-breaking flight, Hughes became one of the most popular figures in America. There were many underhanded politicians at the time who wanted Hughes to run for president. They shouted his name from the rooftops. But Hughes, like Christ, had no love for politics or politicians, so he refused the bid. He wouldn't fool the American people with empty talk and campaign promises that don't mean a damn. He had too much love for the American people for a trick like that. Like Jesus, Hughes believed passionately in a common man. Now, today we have our hippies, our dropouts. Isn't Hughes then a kind of giant hippie? The man with the sneakers and the long hair, unshaven, unkempt, but still regal. and beyond that word regal to prophet, for Hughes is a seer if anyone on earth is. Our children today have their communes. Hughes has his own commune. Both have retreated from a world of lies and infamy. Our youth are searching for a better world, a world not made up of false values and power. Hughes, like all prophets too, is searching for a world that is free and lets people live their own way. For Hughes, like our youth, has gone back to nature. That man has the right to be free. And we call Hughes a prophet, and is he not? Over 30 years ago, Hughes experimented with huge aeroplanes that were the ancestors of our modern jets we fly today. In Hollywood, Hughes made the kind of films years ago that the modern studios of today try to make. Hughes made our first X-rated film, The Outlaw, starring Jane Russell. Now, as a boy, Hughes loved music and taught himself to play the saxophone. Hughes loved the underground music of his time. Hughes played what some today would consider the hard rock of his time. We can safely say that Howard Robard Hughes, billionaire, in his youth, like the youth of today, did his thing. Now, you might ask yourself, how can we compare Hughes to a prophet like Christ? Because in his earlier years, Hughes enjoyed the company of so many beautiful women. Well, did not Christ mingle with all the people? So Hughes mingled with all the people. For he is as American as Mom's apple pie, this man of thought and genius. America, wake up! There is a giant in our world, and now let's meet him. The man on the cross of gold with the heart of thunder. Where does this story begin? Where does it end? It begins December 24th, 1905, the date of the billionaire's birth. Howard had a normal childhood, but his education, however, was quite erratic. He went from public school to private school with regularity. He made good grades, except in spelling. Like the dropout of 1972, Hughes was ahead of his teachers. They weren't teaching him enough, and his curious mind took him far beyond the range of regular schooling. When he was 16 years old, his mother died. His father mourned for a while, as he loved his wife very much. But the state of mourning was not a long one. He soon was seen with actresses, chorus girls, and models. It was the period of the happy time in America, the glorious 20s where gin flowed like bullets, and in many places, bullets came more often. Young Howard was impressed with that period of life, and so he, too, went searching for fun. It was during this era that he entered Rice University. He did very well scholastically, particularly in mathematics. Then, just as he was coming into his 18th year, his father died. Big Howard Sr. was talking business in his office one day and just keeled over. His heart couldn't take the excessive weight. The business fell to Howard Jr. However, there was the condition that he had to share it with relatives. This he did not want to do. He approached the family, telling them that he would buy their shares. They laughed and said he was too young. Legally, he could not enter into contracts until he was 21. Then he began to read law books with a vengeance. And finally, he came across a provision in the Texas Civil Code that stated that if he could convince the courts that he was competent, he could legally enter into contracts. He and his lawyer went to court and proved his competency. A young lad, not yet 20, standing up in a court of law fighting for his right to enter business. This was the first courtroom for Hughes, but in his life, there were to be many more. But in going back to that time and seeing that youth arguing cases with men twice his age, we think of our own youth today. A little confused, perhaps, but ever fighting for their ideals and a better way of life. His competency, now legally proven, Howard quickly negotiated with his grandparents and other members of the family, and at the tender age of 19, he owned one of the biggest businesses in Texas, the Hughes Tool Company. Now, what kind of a business was it? Let us take a look for a moment at Hughes' father, Hughes Sr. He had been born 36 years earlier in Lancaster, Missouri. Hughes Jr.'s mother was born Aline Gano, a beauty of the time. Hughes Sr. started out to be a lawyer, but soon he heard the call of oil. He had a partner named Walter Sharp. Together, they drilled several wells for themselves and also as contractors for others. But wherever they would drill, they would hit hard rock and their drills would break and halt the work. Hughes Sr. didn't rest until he cracked that problem, and finally he did hit upon it. He and Sharp filed for a patent on a drilling bit that could penetrate the hardest rock, and so became the kings of the drilling industry. The Hughes drilling bit was an absolute necessity for all those who searched for oil. They founded the Sharp Hughes Tool Company in Houston to manufacture the drills. But in 1917, Walter Sharp died, and Hughes Sr. became the sole owner by buying out Sharp's interest from his widow. So now, after Hughes Sr.'s death, the business came into the hands of Howard Hughes Jr. He took on his role with the zest of the elite. He was way ahead of his 19 years. He had the organizational genius to hire truly talented men to work for him. And so the business began to bloom even more. Howard also did something else. He married. Ella Rice was a beautiful girl, daughter of the founding family of Rice Institute. Always she had had the cream of Texas society around her. Dashing young men from all walks of life serenaded the young beauty. But now that Howard was the sole owner of the Hughes Tool Company, he could do far more than just serenade for his lady's hand. And in 1925, he and Ella were wed. Leaving his tool company in good hands, young Hughes searched for other fields to conquer. He looked west, to California, to Hollywood, capital of mystery and madness. Hollywood in those days was the glamour center of the world, and so young Howard reasoned that he could have both the glamour and the mystery. After his 20th birthday, the young man blew out his candles and made a resolution that decided that movies were for him. Howard came west in 1925 with his dreams, his beautiful wife, and his millions. And Hollywood waited for young Hughes to be fleeced of those millions. They didn't like fellows who started in at the top. Young Hughes meant that with his money, he would be the producer, the director, the designer, the whole film. An unknown actor had sold Hughes a story called Swell Hogan. Hughes directed the film. It was never released. It also cost him $80,000, a lot of money in those days. It was his first try, and he learned. The next film would be a success. He learned to hire a good director and good actors. Now Hughes began reading countless scripts and looking through directors' resumes. He wanted to make a first-class film. And on his third try, he succeeded. In fact, this film won an Oscar. It was called Two Arabian Nights, and it starred two unknowns who were to become big stars, Louis Wolheim and William Boyd, the latter becoming famous as Hopalong Cassidy. Also in the cast were two of Hollywood's greatest future stars, Mary Astor and Boris Karloff. The critics raved about the film, and Howard Hughes, movie maker, was firmly established. Now Howard wanted to make the greatest spectacle of all, the film of films. He wanted to make a super epic of the air, of World War I and the flyers who lived and died preserving democracy. He bought 80 old World War I airplanes and hired over 100 stunt pilots, with even more in reserve. He hired Luther Reed from Paramount to direct it, and he signed Ben Lyon to play the leading role. He would call the film Hell's Angels. In the annals of movie land, no film was ever made under such conditions as this one. Hughes constantly strove for reality. Every day he'd shoot the scenes of fighting in the air over and over. He'd have balloons burning and real planes plunging to the ground. He'd look at the rushes every night and call in people to watch. Never had such fight scenes of air combat been shown before. But Hughes was not satisfied. Something was wrong. Something didn't fit. And then his pilot's eye saw it. There were no clouds. The Los Angeles sky was blue and cloudless, and without clouds, you couldn't see planes moving. The action was static without a background. Hughes, the prophet again. The seer striving to be real, so far ahead of the Hollywood rivals who had waited in vain for him to be fleeced. Every morning, Hughes would get up before dawn and search the sky, seeking out a cloud. He wanted real clouds, and if he couldn't find any, he'd return to the studio and cancel the shooting. Just 23, he was the youngest man on the set, most of his employees being much older than the boss. To the stuntmen, the flyers, the other actors, Hughes was a rich kid having fun with motion pictures. But he had a purpose. a prophetic purpose, and soon the others would realize it. But sometimes he could be irritating. When they needed rain for a scene, he demanded it be shot in real rain, regardless of whether the actors got soaked or not. Hughes wanted realism. So Hell's Angels produced the highest rate of accidents and casualties of any film made up to that time. One plane struck a high-tension wire. The pilot was burned alive. In one instance, when a plane was buffeted in a storm, the pilot found it difficult to navigate and crashed. This film was written in blood and money. Millions had been spent. Many lives had been lost. But Hughes, the prophet of films, was blazing new trails and facing the dangers that all pioneers have to face. And he left a legacy of knowledge for other producers and directors to draw upon. Finally, the movie was completed in 1930. But something had happened. Something that Hughes had not counted on. Hollywood had learned to talk, and Al Jolson sang in The Jazz Singer. Sound had come to motion pictures. He held a sneak preview of Hell's Angels, and he watched miserably as the audience grew restless, talked, and squirmed through his carefully laid out scenes. As he left the theater, he said, "It will be done again, but this time with sound." He had spent millions so far, and now to spend it all again? But Hughes was shooting for the moon and the stars. He was striving to bring something new to motion pictures, and by God, he would. The female star of Hell's Angels was Greta Neeson, a beautiful Norwegian girl, but she could barely speak English. Hughes knew she had to be replaced for sound. He went through a frantic search for an actress, testing many of Hollywood's finest, but to no avail. It's been said that one day on a crowded set, Ben Lyon, the leading actor of the film, saw a striking blonde, a beautiful girl. He asked her if she would like to play the lead in Hell's Angels. "Why not?" she said. She was brought to Mr. Hughes, who screen-tested her and signed her on the spot. Her name was Jean Harlow. Once again, the cameras started, the planes went up in the air, and Hughes began to breathe life into the film again. But on the home front, there were problems. Ella Hughes felt neglected. Often she didn't see her husband for days, even weeks. So one day she packed her bags and went home to Texas and a divorce. Hughes didn't contest it. He would eventually pay her alimony in excess of $1 million. But now the film was drawing to a close. It had cost well over $4 million, more than any other film up to that time. Also for the length of time of shooting, it had been begun in 1927 and was not finished until May 1st, 1930. For the premiere of the film, Hughes's thundering imagination came to the surface. He would open it at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. He lined Hollywood Boulevard with special lights. He also had colored searchlights in the overlooking Hollywood Hills to cast their beams on the theater. Planes were zooming overhead, dropping flares and banners. It was the premiere night of nights. Hughes, that young prophet from Texas, had proven himself. Hundreds of Hollywood's leading stars of the period were going into the theater, including Charles Chaplin, John Gilbert, Gloria Swanson, Cecil B. DeMille, and thousands of others. Ticket prices were high, $11 top. And right around the corner was Old Man Depression. It was a far cry from that night in Hollywood to the apple sellers on Broadway. Two different worlds. But Hughes's world was all glamour, and he ate up every last morsel of it. The reviews next day were fantastic. The new film with the greatest air adventures ever made hit the town like a rocket. It opened in two New York theaters, the first film to do so up to that time. England also loved the film. The papers there recorded that it had no equal on the screen. But now, with success, Hughes began to make errors. He quickly produced three bad films in a row, all imitative of Hell's Angels, proving the old theory that you can't imitate. At this point in his life, Hughes fell in love. This time it was a Broadway showgirl gone Hollywood. Her name was Billy Dove. At first meeting, she ignored it, but he kept after her, this brilliant young millionaire from Texas. Wherever there was Billy Dove, you would find Howard Hughes. He desperately went searching for stories to fit Miss Dove, but the bubbling romance simply fizzled out. So Hughes now turned his prophetic eye onto a new field, the gangster film. New heroes were on the screen, Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson. The saga of tough guys had taken over from the sleek, brown-haired heroes of war and romance films. The gangsters had hit Hollywood, and Hughes now made perhaps the best gangster film of all time. A film based on the Chicago kingpin Al Capone called Scarface. It was directed by Howard Hawks and written by Ben Hecht. Scarface introduced Paul Muni to the screen and another unknown named George Raft. They both went on to great screen careers. Following Scarface, Hughes filmed another Hecht invention. This time, it was the hit play The Front Page. Based on the Broadway success, the film was even more successful. Starring Pat O'Brien on his way to the top, the film was directed by Lewis Milestone and concerned itself with the newspaper business. It became later a prototype for many Hollywood films dealing with newspaper men. Now Hughes had had Hollywood for a while. He would rest on his record, and it would be 10 years or so before he would return to movie making. Hughes the Seer had beaten Hollywood at its own game. He had set the tone for movies that were to be made years later. Quite an accomplishment for a 20-year-old out of Texas. What kind of man is this prophet, Howard Robard Hughes? What's beneath the carefully put together flesh and bone? Why does he live in secret? We know some of the glories of his early life, but what about his later life? What about the women in his life? And in his life have been the most beautiful women in the world. This man, who has owned several airlines, including TWA, and who has made inventions for airplanes, and has accumulated millions and millions of dollars, this man, like all of us, has fallen in and out of love many times, finally stating that he would not remarry until he was over 50. And he kept this promise.